So the name of the talk tonight is, How Do We Infect the World with Love? And so I was sitting this morning, and as I was sitting, suddenly I had this image of this giant boulder that had just dropped down into a lake, and it had just stirred everything up, and the lake was muddy, and it wasn't clear because this boulder had dropped in. And I felt that inside myself. And I also felt that from a kind of collective energy, a response to what happened in Charlottesville this weekend, that there was a kind of shockwave, a stirring up of emotion, of questions. So many things got stirred up. And I think what really came to me and what I felt was important was the allowing of things to be stirred up in that way. In other words, not automatically looking for just the right response, the right way to be with it immediately, but to allow there to be a time of this kind of muddiness and fogginess around something. In other words, that we don't always have to feel that we come to clarity in our hearts and in our minds just like that, that there can be a little time of allowing things to be stirred up. It's a little to me like grief. The emotion of grief is something that can be messy and unpredictable, and everybody has a little different way of doing it. It's not like there's a right way to grieve. There's not a right way to be. And so if we think there's only one right way, I think we can get caught. And I saw on social media, for instance, different people kind of trying to dictate and say, well, this is how you should be and this is how you should respond. I saw one person who was kind of a spiritual type person who said something along the lines of, it's not okay to be angry. If you're angry, it means you're playing into the hands of the haters. But you know, the truth is that anger can be an appropriate response. And in fact, I felt quite angry at Trump for not being more explicit over the weekend and saying and condemning the neo-Nazis for what they did. And I felt angry about that. And I don't have any apologies for that. That was just a response. And so I think, you know, in looking at how we respond, I think there needs to be some space, some compassion, to know that if we have give it some time and we allow the dust, the dirt to settle a little bit, there might be a wise response that comes out of our heart, but that knowing that there isn't only one right response, there are helpful responses and unhelpful responses, skillful and unskillful, but there's not only one right way. And there's a lot of different opinions about that. So I think we have to begin to look into our own hearts and find out what is our intention, and then find some space for how we respond. There's a quote from Lama Rod Owens. He's someone who works a lot with Angel Kyodo Williams. And I like what he said about this. He said, let your love be the container for the anger and despair. Love won't dissolve them, but will offer enough space not to get lost in them. And so I think that's really like creating some space, you know, creating some space so that we don't get lost in it, but that we can allow whatever is there in this dropping of the boulder. We can actually have some time to explore that and not just impose a particular idea. And it's okay to be uncomfortable. And I think sometimes when something like this happens, it shakes us out of a sense of perhaps complacency or an idea that, well, everything's really okay. You know, these kind of incidents happen and they kind of stir everything up in a way. It's like, well, wait, maybe things aren't quite as good as we thought they were. And it stirs up that sense of discomfort and perhaps feeling a little groundlessness. And I think it's okay to give ourselves permission to be uncomfortable, to be okay with it and say, okay, this right now is not comfortable. And what is this terrain like? What is this terrain like of not feeling so easy about something? Can I let myself explore that? And again, not try to force myself or bypass to come to just what I think is the right way to feel or be with something. And that's true whether it's on or off the cushion. And I have this from Pema Chodron. In practicing meditation, we're not trying to live up to some kind of ideal. Quite the opposite. We're just being with our experience, whatever it is. If our experience is that sometimes we have some kind of perspective and sometimes we have none, then that's our experience. If sometimes we can approach what scares us and sometimes we absolutely can't, then that's our experience. This very moment is the perfect teacher, and it's always with us, is really a most profound instruction. Just seeing what's going on, that's the teaching right there. We can be with what's happening and not dissociate. Awakeness is found in our pleasure and our pain, our confusion and our wisdom, available in each moment of our weird, unfathomable, ordinary lives. And so what happened over the weekend, I think we kind of all know that, you know, the causes and conditions ripened in a way that brought it to the surface, you know, and which is quite disturbing to see this happen. It's scary. But I think we also have to remember to remind ourselves of our history, the history of our country. You know, it was built on slavery and the disenfranchising and killing of indigenous people. And we need to be aware of how that still operates. It may not be so blatant. We may not see it every day, but it's still operating. And we need to see how maybe in an unconscious way what's happening in our own minds and also what's happening in our country, and to be aware of that, to really be willing to open that up and say, how is this really operating in ways that I don't normally see it until something like this rears its ugly head? And then there it is. And so coming back to anger, you know, it's what we do or don't do with it that becomes a problem. It's our relationship to anger. If we don't see it and hold it in the context of our hearts, our wisdom, or our awareness, then we can fall into a mindset of hate against hate. You know, then that's not good. As soon as we let hate vanquish love, then we're really in trouble. If it becomes an us against them, when that, this is all there is left, then we've really lost something. We can stand up. We can stand up for what's right, and we can stand up against what's wrong. But if it turns into, if we let hate get into our hearts, then we have lost. And so that's really the place in which being and creating a space and a container for anger within our hearts and with our practice, we can allow, as Lama Rod said, some love and awareness to hold it, to hold the anger. Then it doesn't have to be something that burns us. It can be a force. It can be something that actually motivates us. So it doesn't have to be something that hurts. It can become energy that moves us. And so we can still understand interconnection, the absolute teaching of interconnection, that we're all connected at the heart, but also be clear about boundaries, you know, and understand that because we operate in one way, we may have this absolute love and compassion at one level, and yet at another level, we're acting, and we're acting out of what we need to do to say, this isn't okay, or set a boundary. So these two things aren't incompatible. We don't have to be passive. And sometimes people get that really confused about Buddhist teachings, that there's something about this kind of passivity of accepting everything or saying that because we're interconnected, everything's okay. And that's not it at all. You know, and I think understanding the absolute realm of love and compassion and then how it functions in the relative world can be helpful, that we have these two realms of absolute and relative. And so I wanted to read this from Frank Ostasecki. And he's a man who, probably about 30 years ago, he founded the Zen Hospice. And at that time, San Francisco, where he founded it, was in an AIDS crisis, and people were dying of AIDS, and right and left. And so in San Francisco, they founded this hospice where people would compassionately care for the people dying of AIDS, the people that everybody else had been afraid of and would not really want to be there for. And so the Zen Hospice was a real pioneer in creating care and kindness for people dying of AIDS. And so he was one of the founders of this. And so he has been able to dedicate his life to caring for dying people in their vast and great suffering. And so I really, in reading this book, it's called The Five Invitations, I really felt the depth of his capacity to be present with pain and suffering. And so here's what he said. There is said to be two levels of bodhicitta, and that's the awakened heart-mind. They are the absolute and relative. Through bodhicitta, we transcend narrow self-interest and embrace all things in compassion. In a more secular way, we might speak of universal, everyday compassion. All spiritual traditions point to universal compassion as an innate and essential aspect of existence. In Buddhist thought, it is vast and boundless, the dynamic quality of reality that contributes to harmony. As a facet of love, it is open-ended and unlimited. Universal compassion is the foundation of all healing, an underlying source of benevolence and caring. Its nature is impersonal, yet it is always embracing us, even if we didn't notice. Even if our conditioning has obscured our ability to see it as an integral to all activity. Then there is everyday compassion. This is the compassion that gets expressed in daily life when we help someone, feed the hungry, stand against injustice, change soiled sheets, give a foot rub, listen generously to a friend's broken heart, or contribute to an earthquake recovery fund. We may be effective or ineffectual in our efforts, but we do the best we can. These two facets of compassion rely on each other. Everyday compassion can be exhausting. We get weary and worn out from our repeated efforts to care for our families, to help others, or reduce the world's suffering. This is why everyday compassion must be sourced in the abundance of universal compassion. But it's a two-way street. Universal compassion also needs everyday compassion. Without everyday compassion, universal compassion is just an abstract idea, a big prayer. And if prayer alone were enough to heal the world, we would have ended suffering a long time ago. And so something that I've reflected on and thought about, especially after this weekend, and how sometimes when we look at large gatherings like the one in Charlottesville, sometimes it seems that in a gathering like that, the energy of hate can spread so quickly. It's like people can become infected by hate so readily. And I've asked myself a question, why does it seem easier to infect a crowd with hate? How do we infect with love and kindness? And that's a question I've had. How do we infect with love and kindness? How does that work? And I always look to the work of Thich Nhat Hanh when I have this question. And I remember at the start of the Iraq War, Thich Nhat Hanh offered a peace walk in Memphis, Tennessee. And so I went to that peace walk. And it was a large gathering of people. They had monks from Magnolia Village and from Paris. And Thich Nhat Hanh came and he gave a talk. And then we all went out into the park and we walked together. And we walked in silence and there were hundreds of us. And we just walked together in the name of peace and in the name of love and kindness. And it was pretty extraordinary how we all walked together. You know, there were children, people of all ages were all there together in silence, just walking in step through the park. And it was a beautiful gesture, and it was a beautiful act of coming together in this other way, in this way of love and caring. And it was a lovely time. And did it change the course of the war? No, it didn't change the course of the war. But was it worth doing? Yes. I felt that it was worth doing. And it reminds me of something Gandhi said about this. And he said, it's the action, not the fruit of the action, that's more important. You have to do the right thing, It may not be in your power, and it may not be in your time that there'll be any fruit. But that doesn't mean you don't stop doing the right thing. You may never know what the results come from your action. But if you do nothing, there will be no result. And so I was thinking about this, and I thought, what if we all came together for something, not just against. I mean, I think it's really important sometimes to stand up against something. But what if we all just said, we're going to stand for something, we're going to stand for love, we're going to stand for kindness. And we had a gathering, you know, of standing for and standing up for something. And I was just thinking in my mind about that, thinking about Thich Nhat Hanh and how that would be a really lovely thing to do. And across many communities and many cultures, but to do that here in Nashville. And as I was thinking about it, it's funny because somebody sent me an email with the exact same idea. And I thought, wow, maybe that's actually a really good idea to do something like that. So to show a different face, you know, coming together in solidarity around love and kindness. And so I just thought that could be a real counterbalance to what we're seeing when we see the ugliness and the hate that shows up and the brave people that showed up to march against it, you know, and the courage that it took for them to do that in the face of the armed militia that was there. The people that were there, they were armed to the hilt. And of course, three people lost their lives in the midst of this, which was quite tragic. But it doesn't mean we don't stop doing something, you know, that we don't find a way to do something and to show a face of love and kindness and wherever we can and however we can. And I wanted to share another reading from Frank Ostasecki that I found really moving. And this is really a form of reconciliation that I found quite beautiful. Years ago, I was invited by a Zen teacher, Bernie Glassman Roshi, to help lead a multi-faith bearing witness retreat at the former Nazi death camps of Auschwitz. The idea was to immerse ourselves in an environment so unsettling that we had no choice but to drop our habitual ways of thinking. Bernie wrote, "When you bear witness to Auschwitz, at that moment there is no separation between us and the people who killed. We ourselves, as individuals with their identities and ego structure, disappear, and we become terrified. We become the terrified people getting off the trains, the indifferent and brutal guards, the snarling dogs, the doctor who points right or left, the smoke and ash belching from the chimneys. When we bear witness to Auschwitz, we are nothing but all the elements of Auschwitz. It is not an act of will. It is an act of letting go. But we let go of the concept of the person we think we are. Every day, as we sat along the train tracks at Birkenau, meditating, praying, and chanting the names of the dead, we also met daily in small groups to talk about what was happening. The group I facilitated included a woman who told me she had been a child in the camps, as well as the sons and daughters of former prisoners and Nazi soldiers. Feeling restless one night, I decided to go into the camp at Birkenau and meditate in one of the children's barracks. It was a long, grim building that had once been a horse barn. Shortly after I sat down, I heard someone enter the other end of the building. It was the woman from my group who said she had been a child prisoner in the camp. She began to cry and scream in the darkness. I got up and sat beside her, and she kept wailing. I'd never heard such sounds. They were primitive, almost animal-like. The wailing went on for most of the night. No words were spoken. There isn't anything you can say when someone is experiencing such anguish. All you can do is bear witness. As the light began to break, we returned to the hostel and silently said goodbyes. Later that day, I flew to Berlin to teach a workshop on grief and forgiveness. I didn't mention my experience at Birkenau. It can still be difficult to speak of such things in Germany. As the workshop was ending, a day or two later, however, a woman in the very back of the room stood up and said, "I've been listening to you talking about forgiveness, but my father was a prisoner in the concentration camps, and I can't forgive his killer. My heart is like ice. The whole room went silent. Again, the only appropriate response was to bear witness. Then a woman on the other side of the room raised her hand to speak. I thought to myself, now the stories of the camps and the grief of those losses will come. She stood and said, my heart is like ice too. It feels like a stone. My father was a Nazi officer who was a guard in the camps. I know that he killed people. I can't forgive him. Silence. Then these two women did the bravest thing I had ever seen. They made their way across the large conference hall of 200 people and embraced. They didn't say a word. They didn't have to. They just held each other. Their actions were a clear recognition that they were no longer alone in their pain. For that moment, the suffering was all of our suffering.